our webinar series. Today, our webinar is going to focus on human risk and specifically how to build a cyber resilient workforce. And that's especially in the age of deepfakes, where attackers are increasingly targeting the end users. And we'll come on to some of those examples a little bit later. But clearly, with the success of some of the recent high profile breaches, we could talk about Jaguar Land Rover, we could talk about Marks and Spencer's, Co-op, Harrods, and plenty more. And obviously, they're just the ones in the UK, but plenty more around the globe. With all those breaches being so successful, it's clear that current awareness campaigns must be falling short where they're all targeting those end users for that successful breach. Is it the targeting of those users, or is it that the users are growing deaf to those security awareness campaigns? We're hoping we'll find out the answer to that today, but most importantly, how we can approach this differently so that we can enable our users to successfully defend our business, defend our data, and defend our customers. So on to today's panelist that is joining me today to help answer those questions, or probably take the lead is probably more accurate. We've got my colleague, Brian Martin. So Brian is the Director of Product Management at Integrity 360, and he's responsible for managing and developing all of our group's portfolio of cybersecurity services and solutions. So plays a huge role in what we do, and is definitely a technical leader in the cybersecurity sphere. So Brian has extensive experience in his career across IT, software development, telecoms, and over 10 years focusing on cybersecurity in all of its aspects, including the technology, the services, the processes, and the best practices. And he spent a lot of time focusing on human risk. So definitely the right man for the job. So welcome, Brian.
Thanks, Rich. Great to be here.
So just before we kick off, I'm just going to flag that this session is being recorded, and also that you'll have a Q&A function or Q&A button as part of your Zoom screen there. Please do use the Q&A throughout this session to ask questions, and we will answer all those in the Q&A session right at the very end. So before I hand over to Brian to kick things off, or in general, I'm going to kick off with a poll question. So our first poll question that we'd like you to answer is how well developed is your human risk program? So select an option there. Is it well, very well? So it's very well developed. Is it maturing? Is it underdeveloped? Or what is human risk, or what is a human risk program? If you are clicking that one, you're definitely in the right place for us to help you with that. So we'll just give you a couple of seconds more there to answer that poll, and then we can have a look at the results. So I think we've got a good number of, I see a few more answers coming in there. Thank you, Rebecca, has just cleared that off. So there will be other polls. So if you didn't have a chance to put your answer, don't worry, you'll be able to participate in some of the other parts. And I think, obviously, we generally get a bit of a broad spread. Surprisingly, three people answering the what is human risk? As I say, you're definitely in the right place. But Brian, I think generally that's probably our view of where people are between underdeveloped and maturing. Obviously, great to see that some are in the very well-developed category there. So as people leading for the front, and I guess hopefully from this webinar we can. Let's see, actually, is that the case? Is there more that everyone can do? So, some interesting results, and hopefully, we can turn, assist all those people that have responded. So, with that, Brian, I'm going to stop sharing, and hand the share over to yourself, and we can really kick off.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks, Rich, and interesting to see the poll there. So hopefully some of the content here will help organizations and people attending to think about what they can do going forward. So I'm going to start with the human security landscape and what it what it currently looks like. And Interestingly, as we see every year, like the likes of the Verizon data breach report, the latest one says that over two-thirds of all breaches involve a non-malicious human element. So 68%, in fact. Very often we know all about exposures and attack paths, and very often the person, the user, is the initial attack vector. It doesn't mean they're not exploiting other vulnerabilities and exposures, but certainly it's a way in for many threat actors. In this case, as we're seeing from the data, two-thirds of breaches. However, our security spending, 80% of it, is aligned more with protecting infrastructure, devices and networks. And I know that's a little bit, it can be, a little bit trite, because obviously end user devices, have protections, and therefore, you are in essence protecting the user by protecting the end devices. But having said all that, when you compare the 68% to the 80% of investment on non-human related, direct human related investments, it shows a little bit of a disparity in terms of our thinking around addressing this particular issue. And the fact is, work has changed, but we as humans haven't changed that much. And there's different ways to look at this. There's obviously the malicious insider threat side of things, where malicious insiders exploit their access, whether it's to steal, sabotage, personal gain, revenge, and so forth. Then you've got the likes of accidental, unintentional, which is falls within the 68%, unintentionally exposing organizations through negligence and lack of awareness. And then you also got, again, the end users that are targeted by the threat actors, and they're, route one is, social engineering through various methods and channels, exploiting and coercion to, gain access to credentials, deploy malware into the environment, or to trick people into making bad financial transactions or leaking sensitive data. So work has evolved. Even though work has evolved a lot, we still spend on average 28% of the average workday in reading and creating emails. I was actually surprised by this, because for me, it feels more like 75%. It probably is more like 28%, but it just feels like we're spending so much time in our inboxes. And then what's happening now as well is that we're also accessing a plethora of other applications to do our work, whether it be, the now ever-present generative AI applications like ChatGPT and Copilot and so forth, or on messaging applications like Teams, Slack, platforms like this, conferencing, Zoom, Microsoft Teams. File sharing applications, Salesforce. So a lot of the kind of the daily routine is now involved in lots of other platforms and communications channels than just your traditional email. Humans have not evolved to the same extent as work has. So in spite of all of this shift in where we're spending our workday, it's been long the case that the majority of the risk is actually coming from the minority of the users. So based on recent research, 80% of the risk comes from about 8% of the users. And that's very useful information, because you don't want to necessarily treat everyone the same from a risk management point of view. It reminds me of when I was in school, and whenever somebody did something bad in the class, then the whole class got punished because the teacher didn't know who had actually done that thing, and therefore, everybody got punished and kept late, or got extra homework, or other forms of punishment. So, having the visibility of the risk profile is crucial. Machines have evolved. So as we can see here, alarming rise of AI-powered phishing and Gen AI scams, all the way up to and including, deepfakes type scenarios, which we'll cover a bit more detail later. So things are evolving. The workplace, the technology, the applications we use, but as humans, we tend to evolve a lot slower than that. So it all brings on to the human security challenge. So the likes of generative AI has resulted in a massive surge in phishing emails and better crafted phishing and social engineering emails since the advent of generative AI. So it's up 1265%. So it's like a 12-fold increase that we're dealing with. 68% of breaches start with phishing, and there's a malicious email hitting an inbox every 42 seconds. Interestingly, workers, they often know that what the right thing to do is, but they don't always do it. So 71% admit that they do risky stuff, but it's just too inconvenient for them to do the right thing, so they work around it. Some of them just believe they know more than they actually do, or are overconfident, and they skip their security training. And what are we trying to achieve here? I mean, it's basically we don't want to become fall victim of some form of a breach or an incident. And again, based on the research, the average global cost of a breach is $4.4 million. So lots changing and a lot to deal with from a human perspective. And all these trends are driving the increase in human risk. Obviously, remote and hybrid working since 2020 has expanded the attack surface and reduced visibility. Plus, people are not always as surrounded by their colleagues and someone they can just ask about something unusual. They might be isolated. They might be working from a home office or sitting on a train or in a cafe or whatever. AI tools and Gen AI agents are introducing new avenues for data leakage and ways of misusing data. And actually, what I'm hearing more and more is that threat actors are finding that many organizations have increased their and improved their security controls, and are finding that the easier route is actually to target the humans, and therefore pivoting more of their attention towards exploiting the initial access through the human route. Also, we're seeing, according to the research, that most organizations are increasing their use of outsourcing. So 68%, according to Gartner, have increased their out use of third parties and intend to do so further for business and strategic reasons. And that obviously expands then the footprint of third-party access, which is another form of human risk within your environment as well. So there's a good reason why it's included in all the standards, the frameworks, the regulations. So whether you look at ISO 27000, the NIST framework, CIS controls, PCI, DORA, EU Cyber Resilience Act, and go on and on, they all contain either advice or mandatory clauses and sections to do with having formal security awareness programs. So not to say that this is should be just a compliance tick box exercise, but there's obviously a reason why all the regulation and frameworks insist on including it as a mandatory and important security control to have. So moving on then to how to think about your people, you can think about human risk in four ways. So from an internal threat perspective, if it's pre-breach, then the internal threat is really your negligent user, your user that accidentally leaks information or is misusing tools and doing things which put the organization at risk. And post-breach is the idea of a malicious user or an insider, which can cause damage. Obviously, if they're an insider malicious user, then you're already breached because they do have some form of access inside your organization. Then you've got your external threats. So if it's pre-breach, then it's really the targeted users that the threat actors are going after to gain illicit access or to socially engineer them in some way for for whatever they're trying to achieve on their attack path. And then post-breach, there can be considered a compromised user in that they're the access has been gained, the malware has been deployed, the credentials have been leaked. And therefore, you now have a compromised user within your environment that can go on to create other issues. So there's lots of when you think about these four types of human risk, I won't go into all the details here, but you can see that malicious users, they could be disgruntled, perhaps they've been bribed in some way, which we've seen evidence of increasing bribery going on. Maybe they're exiting the business and they're trying to bring some intellectual property or customer lists with them or some other useful information in their next job. You've got your negligent user who, you're picking up the signals potentially around, phishing test failures, not taking their training, using shadow IT or using applications in a risky way. And then you can move over to the external threat side. There are signals to pick up on who's being targeted and how they're being targeted. And then the compromised user, typically we have a lot of security controls and security monitoring in place in order to detect anomalous activity around a compromised user, whether it is, impossible travel or, people logging in at strange times of the night or over the weekend and doing things that they don't normally do. So, based on that profile, I'd just be very curious as to how people see that breakdown between the insider threats versus the targeted non-malicious users. So how much of a threat do you consider insider threats versus those? So are you most worried about the insiders or the non-malicious users? Is it both equal, or you're not really worried about either? So we'll just let the poll run for a moment. And the race is on. So we've got insiders and non-malicious neck and neck, and then we've got the winner by a strong margin is both are equally a threat. So I think, so the camp is kind of divided. 50% have a preference or kind of a more concerned about either insiders or non-malicious, whereas the slight majority are seeing both equally as a threat.
I suppose probably the difference there between them, Brian, is probably potentially the impact, I guess. So depending on what the insider risk user is doing, but the breach of a non-malicious user, we've seen in quite a few of the larger breaches there. But as those two are equal, you could probably say that that's does that e equal to being both of them being a threat? So everybody's correct overall on average.
Yeah, exactly. Just maybe someone has a slight extra concern around one over the other. Okay, thanks for that insight. So as I said, just these different type of users and different users have different risk profiles. So who's who? Who is the compromised user? Who is the risky non-malicious user? So risk measurement is key. You need to be able to have the context of understanding where the risks are within the organization, overall for the organization, then also within groups and specific groups, because obviously some groups as well present more risk than other groups, particularly, for example, if you consider privileged access users can represent a higher risk than standard users. And so really important to do that profiling. So human risk management is about understanding and adapting response based on risk and context. And if you've got a user who is being, is profiled as having very low risk, then you only need low intervention, low maintenance around the management. Whereas on the other extreme, the gentleman on the right, who looks a bit scary actually, is flagging very red from a risk profiling perspective, and therefore much higher intervention is required. And then obviously you have a whole spectrum in the middle as well. So moving on then to some of the psychological side of things and how AI is changing that. It is presenting new attack vectors. So for any of you that attended our Security First conferences anywhere this year, we had a great speaker in Dr. Nicola Fox Hamilton, who's a cyber psychologist. And she presented on the different aspects of how psychology is used against us for social engineering and cyber manipulation. And really what the threat actors do is they manipulate common motivations and emotions. So they use things like greed, fear, and ego to get us to click on that link or to look at that file, open that file, or take some action that they want us to take. They also prey on our cognitive biases. So we all have inherent biases or a confirmation bias, things that confirm our original belief about something, or just something by mere exposure, continuous exposure, seeing it over and over again, you inherently start to trust it. And that's why so many people fall foul of these like shipping scams about, clicking to, pay that little charge for accepting your delivery and things like that. And also in the absence of any other evidence that we're biased in a lot of cases to believe that someone is telling us the truth, if we don't otherwise have any other signal that's not the case. Different principles of persuasion, authority, social proof, scarcity, click now because it's going to end at midnight, or this opportunity is going to disappear very, very quickly. And then overriding rational and deliberate reasoning. So using things like distraction, personalization, where they've maybe got some information to conduct more of a targeted spear phishing type activity towards you, and also creating urgency and things like that, that it's something needs to be acted on immediately. So all of this are common techniques to be used against our unsuspecting team members. What AI brings then is an armory of new tools for the social engineers to target and to introduce what we can consider to be social engineering 2.0. Again, if anybody attended, I won't dwell on this too much because if anybody attended any of the Security First, they would have got some presentations around how easy is it now to clone a voice. So I gave this example where there's something on our website with me giving a presentation not dissimilar to one like this, where you could literally just download the content and extract the audio, import it into a voice cloning tool, and I presented how I could, might clone my own voice, and I even went on to demonstrate how then I could speak, 15 different languages. So again, I won't redo that demonstration. But the use cases for this, it's so easy now. I think with about 10, 15 seconds of someone's voice, you can get a reasonably credible clone of their voice and then get that voice to say anything. And that then is very useful to a threat actor. So if anybody's got any footprint out there where their voice is available in the public domain, then that can be used to fake voicemails, audio messaging. You can have live audio conversations. The CEO rings up employee. They've got all the prepared, banter and different voice prompts ready to go to replay over the communication. And within a minute, convince someone to take some action or to make some financial transaction. And also off-camera conferencing. How many of us have gone on to conference calls and the camera's not working? So again, you can do the same thing off camera. And also then with lip syncing, you can also combine with video as well. So real-time face swapping is a thing now. So anybody can swap somebody else's face onto their own and conduct a live conference call. And we've seen this year has been seen the rise of hiring fraud with the rise of deepfake job interviews, where this is particularly predominant out of North Korea, but not exclusively, where Korean IT workers have been hired into remote IT jobs. And not only are they now getting paid significant salaries, but also gaining access inside and becoming a malicious insider within those organizations as well. So a massive increase in HR fraud there, fed by the advent of these new tools. And if you look at the latest now, it's all about, all the buzz now is about real-time mocap or motion capture. And it's not just actually facial motion capture, but, up to and including full body motion capture, where you can superimpose on top of an image, which, just take an image of anybody and then represent that person taking the same motions as yourself. So the technology is moving on leaps and bounds, and just with a simple application and a mobile phone and a video camera, you can achieve impressive deep fakery. So what's the workflow for social engineering in this context? Generally, it starts with messaging. So attackers masquerade as a legitimate authority, then they write personalized messages. They use Gen AI to help with the language side of things, creating the urgency. And then they combine that with other forms of cloned voice audio messages, doctored pictures, and video. So there's loads of examples out there, both messaging, audio, and video deepfakes that have resulted in significant fraud and financial transactions. In the case of the one in Hong Kong, the company remitted $25 million to five bank accounts belonging to the threat actor by using a deepfake video and audio on a Teams call. So what do you do about this then? How do you build a cyber resilient culture? So basically, it's obvious you name, shame, and blame, right? So obviously that's not the case. But because actually, and again, this goes back to what Nicola was saying back at her talk at Security First, scolding, blaming, or shaming people who fall for scams is actually ineffective. It means that if they see that is the culture, they won't ask questions, they won't raise issues, and crucially, they won't raise the flag. If they happen to make a mistake and do something wrong, they'll put their head down and hope that it goes away. And also, to be fair, scammers are creative and sophisticated, and we are all vulnerable. Nobody is immune to this. Everybody can fall for this in a week or a distracted moment. So really, that's not the answer. I don't think you can shame the entire organization into never being exploited like this. So really what we got to do is embrace the human element in cybersecurity. And rather than thinking about humans as the weakest link, think about them as the biggest opportunity. So there's a few different ways to think about this that I think are helpful. So rather than exclusively focusing on prevention, i.e., nobody will ever make a mistake again, get 100% success rate in blocking any social engineering attempt or trickery. That's chasing an impossible goal. Humans do create risks that will lead to incidents. So move from a prevention to a more of a resilience type mindset. Yes, of course, you want to prevent as much as possible, but you want to be resilient in the face of things happening. Make sure that incidents are reported, that suspicious activity is flagged, so that you can cut things off at the pass from a threat point of view, or if something does breach your defenses, that you respond quickly and recover quickly from it. We also need to rethink the language we're using. So rather than the us versus them, the users make stupid mistakes. I remember years ago hearing people make use the expression "there's no patch for stupid," and I thought it was a bit derogatory, that type of language is kind of self-defeating, and it's really unfair as well, because we it's more we it's everybody together, and we're all prone to mistakes, but we can all collectively improve the cyber culture. Then from a tactical point of view, rather than just thinking about our compliance training and getting our annual training and then take out the stick for anybody who fails or we've managed to trick, experiential learning, helpful nudges, shift habits, change behaviors, and crucially, targeting it and making it risk and context specific, so that not everybody again is being tired of the same brush in terms of what they need to support them in their evolution from an awareness and behavior and a culture point of view. So again, moving from prevention to resilience, so rather than preventing employees from clicking links and creating risk, of course, that you do want to try and do that, but also resilience goes beyond that to report emails, mitigate risk, report things that have mistakes they've made. Developers introduce vulnerabilities, to yes, of course, that can happen, but from a resilience point of view, you want your developers to adopt secure coding practices. Prevent employees from reusing guessable passwords. You do want them to use strong passwords, but resilience is about, having practices and policies and support enabling supporting technologies such as, password managers to significantly improve the resilience of the organization. And if you're struggling today with, well, people are a bit apathetic about security awareness, and they groan when they have to do their security awareness training and things like that. Well, then really what you're talking about is a culture change, an organizational change that is required. And there are models out there for affecting organizational change. And it is a, it is the well-known established fact that, changing culture is notoriously difficult. There's the famous quote that maybe was from Peter Drucker, although his organization can't find any record of him actually ever saying it, but he said, apparently said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And what it means is that if the behaviors are ingrained in the culture, then it's very, very hard to change that. No matter what, how beautiful your strategy is around what you were planning to do. So here's one example of a quite a common and well respected change management model, the Kotter's 8-step change model, broadly overlaid with, in the context of changing the security culture. So, it starts with creating an urgency, that there's actually a mobilizing event or a mobilizing rationale for changing. And one of the biggest one we see is when an organization suffers an incident or a major incident, but obviously you don't always want to wait for that. So there's ways of creating that urgency through leadership and case studies and looking what peers are doing and creating that urgency, building the coalition across the organization with cross-functional leadership, considering best practice behavior and cultural programs, which I'll get onto in a moment, communicating the vision and empowering, then moving on to building out short-term wins and consolidating. Things like changing culture involves modeling exemplar behaviors, celebrating heroes, rewarding good behaviors, and instilling the cyber resilience. And this is not something that you can just do once and then it's in place forevermore. You need to maintain this, maintain that vigilance over time as well. So just consider this type of model or something akin to this if you truly want to achieve a lasting change in your cybersecurity awareness culture. And cyber, so creating a cybersecurity culture, you can't have too much psychological safety. It's an environment where people can speak up, where honesty and accountability are respected, and that there are benefits for speaking up, and that you're recognized as a higher performing team when you do model that type of behavior. And there's things that get in the way of that. We never want to look bad. We always want to look good. And if the organization is very hierarchical, sometimes the bad news gets buried down below. We don't want to admit any faults, and we're afraid of punishment and shame and things like that. But that is counterproductive from a cybersecurity perspective. So celebrating the heroes isn't just about the person who spotted the anomaly and took action. It could be the person who actually made a mistake but then spoke up, and through their rapid action, actually headed off a much bigger issue for the organization by doing so. That's why we're now talking about, we're going beyond just security and awareness and moving more towards security behavior and culture programs. And this concept of, rather than sheep dipping the entire organization in repeated annual security awareness training, that we offer more dynamic nudges that are relevant to individual behaviors. They're trigger based, they're in the moment, they're over different channels, so it could be the security awareness platform, could be your learning management system, could be over messaging and ingrained in some of the security controls that and some of the security applications you're already using. Metrics, having access to metrics, seeing what happens before and after, in terms of behavior changes and being able to measure that, and providing incentives to make it convenient and helpful and easy to do so. So there's lots of different types of nudging that can be done. If the behavior that you're concerned about could be using consumer-based generative AI to generate code, then the web filters could direct the developer to enterprise solutions that are sandboxed and locked down and licensed to the organization and much more secure. Same for salespersons getting real-time prompts about how they're sharing data, or file sharing across multiple business units, and suggestions for adapting the access rights depending on the different behaviors that are being demonstrated within the organization. So going back to our three people, our three different risk profile users from earlier. So you can see here we've got someone who's low risk, and really there's low intervention needed, but you want to turn those targeted users who are presenting quite low risk into protective defenders through training, additional training, different nudges, and helpful content for them. Whereas on the other end of the spectrum, we've got somebody who is a malicious insider. And now here we're talking about flagging red from a risk profiling perspective, revoking, taking action to revoke file sharing permissions. And depending on their, malicious, intent, to make them a secured insider so that they cannot, ultimately, do the damage that they otherwise would have done to the organization. So here's another way of looking at it. There's different zones of risk, and people can be at the, in different zones. The safety zone is the ideal zone where the behaviors and activities are all presenting low risk. However, then they take an action, for example, share a file via Dropbox or a internal confidential file over email or something of that nature. Then they've been moved into the elevated zone. So then you want to have some form of an intervention, a behavior correction. Because what happens is if people spend time in a zone, then that becomes their new normal. And then there's a risk that they will then elevate to a higher risk zone. So what you want to do is you want to identify the behavior and execute on the behavior correction to get back down into the safer zone before a new norm is established in a higher risk area. So now we just move on to our third and final poll. We'd like to ask you what your biggest challenges are in implementing successful human risk strategy. So if you could rank these in order, and there are four there. So depending on
Yeah,
how you
I'll just add that might come up a bit small on the screen and hide some of the ranking options. I'll just expand that across the screen. You should be able to see all of them.
Yep, and you should be able to see five different options, A to E. So now we have results coming in, and it's neck and neck between all five at the moment. So no, I'm reading that wrong, actually.
Yeah, public disclaimer. First time we've run one of these ranking ones, so we might have to interpret the results best we can.
Yep. We shall give it another minute. They're still coming in. What I'll do is I'll just finish one more slide and then we come back to the results, because that might be interesting. So just the last thing I wanted to cover before, just key takeaways then in summary, is that some of us think, well, depending on where I'm sitting in the organization, what can I do? It's above my pay grade to make the whole organization cybersecurity aware and drive a cybersecurity awareness culture within the organization. Well, I think that leadership can be at every level. So I think you definitely need leadership from the top, like the board and the C level. And that's important for setting tone and priorities, that cybersecurity is a business risk, not just an IT issue. And it's everybody needs to take it seriously, allocate the resources and budget for these security, human security programs embedded into the corporate strategy and governance, and lead by example. And again, going back to the culture, if you want your leaders to be exemplar of good cyber hygiene, then at all levels, whether managers, team leaders, anybody with any leadership management position, they're the culture carriers within the organization. They reinforce the security behaviors in their daily activities, recognizing, rewarding people for doing the right thing, and crucially, encouraging the open reporting and not creating a environment of fear to and shame. And then even at an individual level, every employee is a first line of defense. So even individual contributors can promote ownership and ownership mindset. Security is part of my job. And you really know you have a security culture if peers are calling out one another and supporting and encouraging one another to do the right behaviors, positive reinforcement, encourage that peer influence as well. So it's important that we can, demonstrate and take action from a leadership point of view at all of these different levels. So just before I show the takeaways, could we have the results of the last poll, please?
Yeah, so I've got them in front of me, Brian. So I have, I think they're being shared at the moment, but I've deciphered the bars there, and the one that's got the most has been ranked as the most challenging is budget, which I think is, you probably get that answer for most topics when it comes to cybersecurity, the challenge of getting budget. But the second one is getting that senior management buy-in. And it is important that it's all led from the top, or that bought in from the very top. And that is, I'd say, the role of the CISO and the CIO to be making that clear, not board agenda and board level priority to drive down. But as you say, it's really for everyone to be a leader in their own right, to lead from the front and lead by example and be that one that's securing the organization. And then actually in third place, users will be users, which I think is almost throwing the towel in. But I think let's all work collectively to have that as the least challenging.
Yeah, agreed. And users will be users is just another of saying that the culture isn't there, and it's seen as an impossible barrier to try and change that. So again, going back to the idea of, affecting organizational change through change management and culture and behavior programs is crucial in this regard to really build out your human risk approach within your organization. So that leads me on then just to a kind of a key summary of the key points I made today. So pivot that mindset from prevention only to think about resilience. So go beyond just prevention to accept that you're going to have to deal with being resilient, and therefore you can't lock everything down. So you need to think beyond that. Evolve training awareness to be risk-based and context-based, and implement dynamic contextual nudges throughout the life cycle, throughout the daily, weekly, and annual activities. Focus on culture and behavior. So again, consider a change management model to institute that change as part of the organization. Focus on technology solutions that will enable your visibility, measurement, and that risk-based mitigation that I talked about earlier. You do need to be alive to social engineering 2.0, and that's the latest thing, but this never stands still. Next year, we'll be saying there's something else that is the new latest risk. It'll be social engineering 3.0. So this is never one and done. You have to continually evolve your thinking around the types of techniques and tactics that are used by the bad guys to manipulate the humans within our organization. Educate, because AI and Gen AI is the new kid on the block from a technology, a new toy, if you like, within the organization, you do need to educate and protect against some of the new risks associated with that misuse. And finally, leadership is possible and essential, whatever the level. And notwithstanding the last, the poll where, senior leadership buy-in and then getting the budget from the senior leadership is the challenges one and two. That is really where we need to focus in order to take this seriously. So thanks very much for your attention, and I'll hand back to you, Rich, now
Yeah, thank you very
to
much,
lead us
Brian. So
out.
straight into the Q&A. That's it. Thank you very much. So we do have four questions in for the Q&A session. If you do have any other further questions, chuck them in and we'll try and answer them live. If not, we will follow up afterwards and we'll follow up with all of the questions. So the first one there, Brian, is what's the quickest way to get visibility? Assume it's visibility human risk, so of human risk, and the easiest to implement.
Yeah, it's a pretty good question, because there's very complicated ways and there is, a much simpler way, because we have telemetry everywhere. We have SIEM platforms, we're getting telemetry, we're getting UEBA signals and identities performing anomalous tasks or whatever. However, the quickest way, I think, is to implement a human risk platform, conduct testing, gather data, and traditional training, phishing simulation training and awareness platforms have evolved now, or are evolving into being more human risk platforms. A lot of them have new modules. Most of them, if not all of them at this stage, are either started out as an email security platform, and then they introduced the security awareness and the phishing components within them. Or there are ones that started out life as security awareness platforms, and then have actually either organically or through acquisition acquired email and messaging security platforms and provide an integration. So as well as getting the telemetry around risk due to the testing and the training performance and completions, etc., they're getting telemetry from other sources such as email, integrated or their own or other integrated email security platforms. Some of them have insider risk solutions as well that can be built in. So I think I would advise to look at how most of you probably have some form of these platforms in there already, but are you getting the most out of them? Are you actually using them in a way that goes beyond the traditional of rehashing of training and moving it to more the risk and adaptive based profiling as well? And I think by using the platforms in this way, I think we can move quite quickly to a more of a human risk management approach.
Yeah, very good. So another question here from Rian, which is voice authentication systems able to detect cloned voices? No, is the answer. There's been documented evidence of cloned voices and AI deepfakes able to bypass the bank's voice authentication. Now, there are technologies, and I'm sure the voice authentication organizations are embedding that deepfake detection. And obviously, there's deepfake detection technologies that are coming to market that you can embed in your Teams calls as one of those note takers, for example, that monitors all participants to look for deepfakes. And I'm sure there's the same applies to voice authentication. But their effectiveness is only as good as the AI models that they know about. So as soon as a new one comes out, their effectiveness drops from in the 90s right down to the 30% range, just because they have to learn and train actually what are the nuances of that that technology and that cloning to be able to pick those up. So I would say even if the answer becomes yes, it quickly becomes no on those. So it is a real challenge, and I would say is there much future in voice authentication systems? I probably wouldn't be buying shares in any of those right now.
I would also add then, that I think the state of thinking right now is that you can't really rely just on hearing someone's voice in order to determine whether or not the identity behind that voice is the person you think it is anymore. And you need, particularly when there's a either you need to find different forms of validation, such as if you've got some, let's say you shared a book recommendation the prior week when you were talking to this person, then verify, do you remember that book verification or that book recommendation I gave you last week? What was that again? And or find and build into your processes within your organization, particularly when there's significant material transactions involved, whether it's financial sharing of data and so forth, that you need to build your processes to be robust in the face of not having a single factor authentication of thinking you know who's on the other end of the line.
Yeah, I should probably add just following that a quick quip about not buying shares. I'm not a financial advisor, and forward-looking statements and everything else that applies there. And you know, we've got just a couple of minutes left, so I will just go for one more question, and that is, what are the top three low-hanging fruit that will have the most impact in creating a more security-aware culture and behaviours?
So I think number one is a visible leadership commitment. So that is commitment, and it's also visible. So by having that commitment, you get the budget, you get the attention, and you get the leadership demonstrating the right behaviors. And because it came up, I'll elaborate on this first one, visible leadership commitment. How do you get that? Because that was obviously a pain point in the last poll. You need to shift the conversation away from technical jargon around, phishing and even deepfakes and whatnot. And yes, talk about that, but express it in terms of business risk, financial impact, and how it aligns with the strategy. Because the senior execs and the board are primarily focused, if you like, on protecting the company's value, maintaining compliance, ensuring business continuity, and those types of things. So if you can put the argument for this in that sort of language, then that would really help. So that's number one. And also along with that, clear metrics, so establish a baseline. How do you benchmark against peers? And then show improvement over time to show the fruits, if you like, of that attention and investment. The second low-hanging fruit I would say is engaging and continuous business-centric training. So making sure that both the testing side and the training is kept fresh, it's dynamic, it's context and risk aware, so that you are, you have that continuous nudges and reminders going on within the business all the time. And then thirdly, fostering a no-blame reporting culture. So again, there's nothing that's going to kind of stop people from making things visible than by blaming people or shaming people. So fostering that, I think, is crucial as well to start creating the environment for that improved culture.
Brilliant. So the last thing on the agenda there, Brian, if we go to the next slide, is just to remind everybody that we do have some more upcoming webinars. Please register for those. So firstly, we've got breaches happen. Are you ready when they do? So fireside chat with Patrick Ragg, our head of incident response. And if you just flick back there, Brian, because we're just onto the thank you slide just for the other one. And the other one is just looking at SASE in 2026 and what zero trust and AI-driven controls mean for the modern enterprise. So that leaves us just with my last thing to do is just to thank Brian for joining me today and walking through everything human risk and how to build your program and how it can start affecting that cultural change towards security awareness and behaviors. And to thank everybody for joining today, and we hope to see you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye now.